This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
The 26th UN Climate Change Conference is underway in Glasgow, Scotland. It's being billed as one of the most important conferences in human history. That's why we have to put it at the top of the show, right? This is going to save the world from climatic catastrophe. But there is plenty of evidence that this isn't the real agenda at this conference. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's one of the most important conferences in human history or not, but it's definitely one of the most well-attended conferences in human history. There's actually 30,000-plus delegates in Glasgow this week and many staying through next week for this climate change conference. You've got business leaders, world leaders, environmental activists, journalists, religious leaders, everyone from like the Archbishop of Canterbury to Prince Charles to Boris Johnson to Joe Biden to Barack Obama to just basically some representative for every Western nation in the world. Putin couldn't be bothered to go. Xi Jinping from China couldn't be bothered to go. The presidents of Brazil or Turkey couldn't be bothered to go, and they were, I think, fairly open, or at least everyone knows that they're not really interested in hurting their nation's manufacturing or industrial capacities at a conference like this. And then there are a few others who wanted to go but couldn't make it. I think Pope Francis had kind of wanted to go, but he's recovering from colon surgery right now. And I think Al Gore did make it, actually. Pope Francis and Al Gore were the two world leaders who recorded a message for everyone to watch before it. Pope Francis's message calling on everyone to take concrete steps to give hope to future generations. And Al Gore, who's really probably the most responsible for popularizing the global warming movement, did a message saying that it's finally time for the world to say goodbye to oil, gas, and coal. That's why Putin didn't come. He has no intention of saying goodbye to any of those three things. But it's
right. Well, it is interesting to the message that it sends that Putin and Xi Jinping did not attend.
Right. I mean, that is kind of a big thing that you're hearing the analyst talk about, is especially right now. I mean, the world's biggest polluter is China. America's I don't want to conflate pollution with carbon dioxide, since it is a gas that's necessary for life to exist. But like I said, American carbon dioxide emissions have been coming down for years. I don't think the leftists are too happy about the reason, because the fact is that the fracking boom has given us more natural gas, and natural gas burns so much cleaner than coal that right now, like, our biggest source of clean energy is natural gas that we're burning. But our carbon reductions have been coming down for years because of that. China's have not. They're burning more coal than ever and building more factories than ever. Mm-hmm. And so really, even if you're someone who believes that carbon dioxide is causing global warming, and you can definitely count me skeptic on that claim, but even if you're someone who believes it, none of these deals are going to do anything unless China's on board. You start making deals to where America or Europe start curbing back their industry and China doesn't. And well, that's why Donald Trump half jokingly said that global warming is a Chinese hoax, because it really benefits it benefits the people who aren't at the conference.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I want to get to the article that you put up on this in just a moment. But if I could, Richard, you wrote about this conference. You said basically in Britain, it's absolutely wall-to-wall coverage. And you wrote about this in your Trumpet brief on Monday. And you just made the point that the biggest focus at this conference apparently is two countries in particular that are, it's kind of prophetically significant who it is that they seem to be targeting the most.
That's right. I mean, like Andrew said, Russia, China, biggest polluters. If CO2 is a problem, I think it's like a third comes from China. If they're not there, though, well, the focus naturally shifts right to the United States as the world's biggest, as one of the remaining biggest polluters. Again, if you call CO2 a polluter. And then, of course, the UK is hosting the summit. So they are absolutely, you know, they wanted to kind of, you know, the government had so much invested in this. So they wanted to come forward with big pledges and this kind of thing. So it was absolutely these two in the spotlight. And like you said, that's hugely significant because these are the as we talk about so much on this show, these are the modern nations of Israel, Britain and America primarily. You know, these are the nations that have received blessings, not because of anything they've done, but because God promised them to Abraham based on his obedience. These descendants of Abraham have received those blessings, and you know, they haven't used them the way that they could have done for good. And so these blessings are being taken away, and the nations are being actively cursed. And what you see at this conference was an attack on these two nations, part of a much broader attack on these two nations that we've been talking about for a long time. But it was absolutely about tearing down the industry. You know, these two nations have a leading and advanced economy. Both of us are living in America, living in Britain. We have a huge amount of economic prosperity that so much of the rest of the world just doesn't have. And this conference was in so many ways about taking that away, about removing different things. And so many things in there just make no sense from an environmental perspective. You know, you have Joe Biden making it harder for America to drill for oil and by putting in all of these environmental regulations. And at the same time, turning around and asking other countries, hey, we're running short of oil. Could you drill some more for us? So again, environmentally, well, America getting oil from the Middle East is way more polluting than America getting it from Texas. So it doesn't make any sense environmentally. But if it comes to weakening America, America being reliant on Middle Eastern oil when they could be getting it from their own backyard, that weakens America. And that's just one small example. Again and again and again, you see this. Okay, we're going to shut down our industry because it's too polluting. But China doesn't care. So we'll buy the same things from China with a much higher environmental footprint. It's not about the environment. It's about tearing down Britain and America.
That is very compatible with what you wrote about in your article, this article from Andrew Miller, Blackout. Your energy supplies and your rights are fading fast, and talking about this agenda being enacted within America in particular, that this is about fundamental transformation of the world's most powerful nation.
Right. Yeah, I bring up the point in that article is, I mean, you've probably noticed, no matter what nation you're in right now, that gasoline prices are pretty high. I think it's about $3.40 a gallon is the average in the United States. And it's a little cheaper here in Oklahoma, but that's the average nationwide. And the main reason for that is this slew of executive orders that Joe Biden's passed, making it hard to drill. I mean, he's banned drilling in like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a lot of offshore drilling, banned drilling on federal land. The CEO of the Blackstone Institute, that's one of the largest asset managing institutes in America, was just telling CNN recently that it's almost impossible to get funding for a new oil well right now because the Biden administration has clamped down on this so hard in order to cut these carbon emissions like they're talking about at the conference. And that CEO, he was even predicting like civil unrest to be breaking out in nations around the world, especially the developing world, the third world, but even in developed nations, civil unrest as people get desperate because you've already got the inflation problems, you've got the supply chain problems, now you've got an energy crisis on top of that. And it's really squeezing the working class people. There was even an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that I cite in the cite in that article we've got on the trumpet.com talking about how the author thinks that Biden's going to have to choose between his climate agenda and his economic agenda. He's like, said, you basically, to solve the middle, it's like you can choose between cutting carbon emissions or empowering third world dictators and undermining the middle class in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think the way the article we've got on the Trumpet distinguishes itself from the article on the Wall Street Journal is that it's not actually even, he's thinking, it said, well, he's going to have to choose between his climate agenda and his economic agenda. It's like, well, what if his climate and his economic agenda are the same?
Right.
And right. The fact that these carbon cuts to save the environment don't really save the environment, but they're undermining the middle class and empowering third world dictators on purpose, like I said, to tear down America, empower America's enemies while attacking, like I said, the backbone of America's economy, the middle class and small business.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like Richard said, if you look at this in terms of what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been saying for well over a decade about America under attack, if you look at it in terms of the communist infiltration into the United States, it all makes perfect sense. And really, it does not make sense in any other way unless you view this as fundamentally an effort to undermine the United States as a world power. It's doing a fantastic job of that. Well, we could talk about this a whole lot longer than we have. We do have a few articles that we'd like to put up on the link to in the show notes for today's program. There is Andrew's article on the Green Agenda Dismantling America. Richard wrote his Trumpet brief. We'll link to why you need to watch this summit. We'll also point to an article by our editor-in-chief, What the Paris Climate Agreement Was Really About. That was from the last UN Climate Change Conference. And that really does give you the spiritual perspective that you need to understand what's happening here. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. China isn't particularly concerned about climate change, but they are putting their efforts toward more practical matters like beefing up their arsenal of nuclear weapons. That's the warning coming from the Pentagon. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Pentagon released a report on Wednesday saying that China is rapidly expanding its nuclear arsenal and that it could have as many as 1,000 nuclear warheads by the end of the decade. So there was a report that we spoke about last year saying that China was working to double its current number of warheads, bringing it from around 200 up to about 400. But now this updated projection from this week is blowing way past that, and now talking in terms of China not doubling but quadrupling its number of warheads. Part of this report says, quote, "The People's Republic of China aims to modernize, diversify, and expand its nuclear forces. It is investing in and expanding the number of its land, sea, and air-based nuclear delivery platforms and constructing the infrastructure necessary to support this major expansion of its nuclear forces." End quote. So, you know, land, sea, and air means that China now has what is known as the nuclear triad. It can fire nuclear weapons from any of these domains. And the report also discusses those three intercontinental ballistic missile silo facilities that China has recently built, and the fast breeder reactors as well that are just producing so much of that nuclear material. And altogether, it looks like China will soon have no fewer than 1,000 nuclear weapons. So that'll put it very much in the same league as the United States, which has an estimated 5,800 warheads, and Russia, which is number one in the world with a little over 6,000. So it's just a massive increase in nuclear weapons, and it means China's expansion is accelerating at a rate not foreseen even a year ago. So just a dramatic change in the global arms race and just an extremely worrying trend.
It's just made all the more dramatic, isn't it, when you put it in contrast with what we were just talking about, how the United States and so many Western powers, they're putting so much energy and effort into combating climate change. China is putting its efforts into combating other nations, or at least putting itself in a position to be able to destroy other nations if it needed to. And really, it's also interesting to put in context with all of the other moves that China is making that really do demonstrate a very aggressive military posture, generally speaking.
That's exactly right. China has a totally different focus than the U.S. especially. And on Monday, one of these other stories broke showing that it's not just nuclear weapons that China's focusing on. They also have just launched a satellite into space called the Shijian 21. And this is no ordinary satellite. Its main purpose is, well, to use China's wording, to neutralize space debris. So this satellite has a robotic arm that can be controlled by operatives on the ground, and that means it can grab space debris. But the alarming thing is that China sees other nations' satellites as space debris. You know, so the Shijian 21 can basically grab and destroy other countries' satellites. The reality is that this is a satellite crusher. And the Chinese launched it into an area called the geosynchronous orbit, which is exactly where many of America's most sensitive and important satellite systems are located. The Gatestone Institute wrote about this week and said, America's satellites that are critical to nuclear command, communications, and control, as well as surveillance and military communications, are mainly in this geosynchronous orbit. So these are the eyes of some of the U.S.'s most critical weapons and defense systems, and they're just vital for communication as well. And now they are well within reach of this new Chinese satellite killer. This Gatestone analysis also included an interview with geopolitical analyst Brandon Weikert, and he said, quote, "The Shijian 21 satellite is a game changer. It is a real-world offensive capability that can hunt and destroy American systems and render the U.S. military on Earth deaf, dumb, and blind. Because the U.S. satellites in geosynchronous orbit are so far away from Earth, they're both expensive and hard to replace. Losing any of these systems with no replacements on hand would give China's military an unprecedented advantage in the event of an outbreak of hostilities." End quote. So, you know, in my mind, it's hard not to think about this in connection with what we just spoke about, China's rapidly expanding nuclear arsenal, set to quadruple now. When you think about a nation that is investing billions into nuclear weapons at the same time as it's developing this real-world offensive capability to leave the U.S. military and maybe other militaries as well deaf, dumb, and blind, that's just a very alarming reality.
Right, and it was a week ago that we were talking about that hypersonic missile test where they've created a missile that could use some of these nuclear warheads that they're presumably developing to evade any anti-missile technologies and strike anywhere in the world at will. These are really troubling signs coming out of China right now.
Yeah, it's not just the number of warheads, but as you just said, the delivery systems. Now they're able to, you know, send those warheads past even the most advanced defense systems that America or any other country has, so they can put these nuclear warheads anywhere they want to.
So looking at this in light of Bible prophecy, maybe you can just help our listeners to understand why this is so troubling from a prophetic perspective.
Sure, yeah. Well, China's, you know, its rapidly growing nuclear arsenal and its ability to destroy satellites that the U.S. and other countries rely on so much, it all basically shows just how fragile the global peace is right now. And it shows us that the unthinkable, which is, you know, nuclear war, that's becoming much more likely. And if you look at Bible prophecy, there are numerous passages that say a war will soon erupt. And Matthew 24 tells us this future war will be so catastrophic, it'll have the potential to kill all people alive. So we know that that has to be describing just a major nuclear war. So to see China today shifting into overdrive to quadruple its nuclear arsenal and developing the ability to crush other countries' satellites, that indicates just how soon this future war could erupt and how catastrophic it'll be. And we do have a booklet called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. It's written by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, and it goes through all these scriptures to show just how seriously we should be taking the leaps that China's making right now and that other militaries are making. And then he also shows that there's actually some very hope-filled news that closely ties ties into all of this.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Civil war in Ethiopia looks like it could be approaching a decisive turning point. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a story we've been reporting on quite a lot in the past year, just because Ethiopia features into biblical prophecy in a very important way, how we expect the Horn of Africa region to fall into the hands of radical Islam. Ethiopia is, of course, a predominantly Christian nation, and so seeing such a fall has been really difficult to forecast how it would come about. However, when we see civil war really increasing inside Ethiopia, we can really be guided by biblical prophecy to show us the end result. Exactly how it gets there is still obviously something to be worked out. However, the situation this week in Ethiopia shows that it's not getting any better for the people of Ethiopia. This is a civil war that's been has lasted over a year now, when the government of Abiy Ahmed, he was a man that came into power, I guess, two or three years ago. And he was elected to power, and then the big moment in his reign was the fact that he signed a peace deal, or at least they were going to have renewed relations with Eritrea, two countries that have been, Ethiopia and Eritrea, have been at each other's throats for decades, and yet they came together for a peace deal, and that awarded him a Nobel Peace Prize. However, the main reason that he came together with Eritrea was to really force the true source of power in Ethiopia, the Tigrayans, for the past 30 years before Abiy Ahmed ruled over all of Ethiopia, even though they were a small part of the population, about 10%. The Eritreans and Abiy Ahmed both didn't like the Tigrayans. And so now what we're seeing over the past year is kind of something that we would have expected, is the fact that the Eritreans and Abiy Ahmed went to war starting last year against Tigray to basically solidify their hold of power. So civil war has increased over the past year. The Tigrayans, though they form 10% of the population, and have a large percentage of the military. There was massive amounts of the Ethiopian military that broke off about a year ago to fight against the Ethiopian army. And this has steadily increased to the point now that although there was early gains for Ethiopia, the Tigrayan rebels, if you can call them that, are fighting back hard. Last week, the Oromo Liberation Army, this is the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia, about 30%+ of Ethiopia. And even though Abiy Ahmed is an Oromo, and the Oromo people kind of came together to get him into power, these people have now joined up with the Tigrayans to fight against the Ethiopian government. And the Oromo people, they're basically from the south, the Amhara, which is the kind of where the population centers are, the main population centers are. This is the area that is kind of being surrounded now. This is where the Ethiopian army is. And so you have up to 9 rebel groups that are now forming against Abiy Ahmed's Ethiopian army. And so there was reporting coming out yesterday that they're about 15 kilometers away from the capital, Addis Ababa, but they're not. They're probably about more like a couple of weeks away, it seems, from taking the capital. However, they have taken over a couple of critical cities in Amhara that are kind of cities that are along the main roadway that connects Djibouti, the country that it has access to the Indian Ocean, through which Ethiopia survives. Ethiopia, of course, is a landlocked country, and Abiy really needs this roadway to be secured to Djibouti to make sure he can still fund his government. Yet it looks like the Tigrayan forces and these 8 other groups are starting to cut that off. And so while it might have looked good about a year ago for the Ethiopian army led by the prime minister, he has got enemies that are multiplying on the ground, led by the Tigrayans, but now the Oromos are coming for him as well.
And we talked about this recently, Brent, and just putting this in the larger context of what is at stake in Ethiopia and these different forces that you're describing, the effect that this could have on Ethiopia's future and on the region, depending on who emerges victorious here. Could you just remind us of that?
Right. So it is difficult to see what group of these groups are going to form the prophetic future of Ethiopia. The prophecy states in Daniel 11 and verse 40 to 45 that radical Islam led by Iran is going to take control of the area from Ethiopia to Libya. We've talked about this along Sudan, Egypt, and even into Libya. And so we've been looking for radical Islamist elements to really capitalize on the instability in Ethiopia through the civil war. And just which side is going to come out on top, it's still left to be decided. However, I think there is a growing convergence of interest by the Islamist powers with Turkey and Iran at the forefront that are actually siding up with the prime minister himself, with Abiy Ahmed. Back in October, it was reported by Reuters that in August, the Turkish Recep Tayyip Erdogan signed a defense pact with Abiy Ahmed, and he sold him really important drones that have been used in the fighting against the Tigrayans. As recently as 2 weeks ago, Iranian drones were also spotted fighting with the Ethiopian army. And so it does seem that Abiy Ahmed is taking the help he can get from Islamist powers such as Turkey and Iran. And then the more Christian and the leadership that has kind of been in charge of Ethiopia, led by the Tigrayans and others, they are perhaps favored by your traditional anti-Islamist powers existing in Egypt and Sudan right now, at least with the military takeover. Where the United States falls on this would be very interesting. They've called for a halt of the Tigrayan push to take over the capital. However, it is difficult to tell who is the legitimate ruler and legitimate leadership of Ethiopia. Abiy Ahmed, he canceled elections last year because of COVID. And everybody saw that as he's going to clutch onto power. And he came into power wanting democratic rule. And yet here he is canceling the first elections that are due to come up. And that's perhaps why the Oromo people have been going against him as well. And so, again, it is hard to tell right now which power will form will be supreme in the end of this. However, we're looking for radical Islam to really capitalize, Iran to get involved, perhaps Turkey to get involved, because in the end, those biblical prophecies say that Ethiopia is going to fall to radical Islamist elements. And this is the long game that people should be aware of. It is easy to get lost in the details, and it is hard to track, given that there's so many ethnic groups making up Ethiopia. However, I think an article that people can read was just actually put out today or yesterday in the Trumpet Brief, and it's entitled, "Is Ethiopia's Civil War in End Time Prophecy?" And for those prophecies, people can read that article.
All right, very good. Brent, we appreciate you bringing us up to speed on what's happening there, and it is reassuring to just have that long-term picture. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, and as you said, even just to see how the United States comes down on this, we'll find that out more soon, I suppose. But do read that article, "Is Ethiopia's Civil War in End Time Prophecy?" We thank you very much for that, Brent. As Germany tries to form a government after recent elections, many in the political mainstream say it's time to completely rethink the way we choose a leader. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, in the wake of the latest elections and their absolutely disastrous defeat, Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party have set out how they're going to choose their new leader. And it's got a lot of people's attention because it's a radical departure from the way that they've done things in the past. And this, I think, and many other people think, is pretty significant. So typically, they have a small number of delegates that kind of get together and they vote on who's going to be the next leader of the CDU. This time around, it's not going to do that. Instead, they're going to have a vote of all 400,000 CDU members. And what this really is an acknowledgement that things are broken. Like you said at the start there, that this is, the CDU has had a series of bad leaders. You know, they had Armin Laschet to replace Angela Merkel as their candidate. He didn't do so well. He was replacing Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, who was the previous person who was meant to replace Angela Merkel, and she did really badly and ended up resigning. So it's an acknowledgement here, not just that the CDU and by extension Germany needs new leadership. It's more than that. It's an acknowledgement that the way we are choosing our leaders doesn't work. That the whole, that the process has broken down, that the process has repeatedly given us these unpopular leaders that have failed at the election, and we need to do something differently. Politico really also, they focused on this. They had a really good article titled "After Merkel, German Christian Democrats Seek New Savior." You know, they see that they need a big shakeup and they need something different. They also point to the fact that many within the CDU are agitating for a shift to the right and a shift for some leader that's kind of more charismatic and something that's got much more focus on one personality. They quote one of the young union chairman. He's the leader of the young social Democrats, saying there are many younger heads in the party who want a new direction. And the article talks about how a lot of people were looking for a kind of German Sebastian Kurz, who has basically rebranded his party, Sebastian Kurz's party, and built everything about him and his personality. It's someone Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry's focused on in the past. So I think it's really interesting to see the Christian Democratic Union Party heading in this direction.
It's not hard to understand why they would be having this conversation, considering the kinds of deadlocks that they've faced after the last two elections. But it really does just kind of ring your alarm bells when you understand the prophecies that Gerald Flurry has been talking about for years about what we can expect politically in Germany.
That's right. I think this is just powerful confirmation of everything that Mr. Flurry has been writing about Germany. And about watching Germany. And this is the cover article of the latest Trumpet print edition. Europe is about to be hijacked. And the type of leader and the type of changes that the CDU are looking for, what Mr. Flurry and what the Bible really, it's all based on the Bible. What the Bible is forecasting is just a more extreme version of the direction that they're already going in. There's a clear demand for a strong leader and a clear demand to look for somebody different to the type of people that we've had in the past, different from Angela Merkel, a different process even for finding her than we saw with Angela Merkel. And so Mr. Flurry's article in the Trumpet print talks about why we need to watch for this strong leader in Germany. And he says is, it's no coincidence that at this moment, Germany is in acute political turmoil. And that's exactly what this kind of change up is a signal of. And he says that these crises are laying the foundation for the rise of this modern strong leader. And he explains in the Bible, he explains from the Bible why we believe that strong leader is coming. And he talks about how the German election has laid the grounds perfectly for this strong leader to arise. And now you see Germany's typically, the kind of the default ruling party of Germany saying, we need somebody with a strong leader. We need a strong personality. We need somebody different from what we've been looking for. And yeah, that just confirms that these events have perfectly laid the path for that leader. So to learn more about that leader, what the Bible says about him, why he's such a key, he plays such a massive role in world events, why he's so important for Christians to watch, why he ties in with Bible prophecy and how it's all part of God's plan. Mr. Flurry's article, Europe is About to Be Hijacked, is a great place to go to study all of that.
Very good. Thank you very much for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at the hardball energy politics Vladimir Putin is playing with Europe, and we'll see how at least one European nation is responding to such threats. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Russian President Vladimir Putin wants the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to start operating, and he's making sure the Europeans who are holding the project back get that message very strongly. For this, we'll turn to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we spoke on the show 2 weeks ago about how Russia was weaponizing its natural gas supplies by just slowing down the flows through the Yamal pipeline. That's the pipeline that goes from Russia through Belarus, then through Poland, and finally into Germany. And we talked about how this reduction was leaving some Europeans in the cold and basically just confirming everyone's fears that Russia will increasingly use energy as a weapon. But this week, the whole situation got considerably worse. Russia has now completely shut down the flows through the Yamal pipeline. So there has been no gas at all flowing through that for almost a week now. And then with its main pipeline through Ukraine, Russia has cut the supply there to about one half the usual amount. So these are just drastic and dangerous reductions. And we know that the construction on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is finished now. That's the one that bypasses Eastern Europe altogether and just sends Russian gas directly into Germany through the Baltic Sea. But there is some resistance inside of Germany and some other European capitals about allowing Russia to turn that Nord Stream pipeline on. So with these dramatic cuts through the other pipelines, Russia is applying some serious pressure on Germany and on the rest of Europe. And that pressure is only going to intensify as the weeks continue on and as the nights get longer and colder. So it's just a very disturbing pressure tactic by the Kremlin here.
The message from Russia is pretty unmistakable here, and the fact that Vladimir Putin actually has the weapons to back this up is not lost on European leaders at all.
That's exactly right. And if it was lost on any of them, there's another development that also happened this week that would have removed any doubt. Just at the same time as he's been increasingly weaponizing energy just to try to force other countries to submit to, to Russia's will, the Russian military is also massing troops and military equipment near its borders with Europe. This is based on some new commercial satellite photos that were taken on Monday by the Mazar Technologies Group, and they show a buildup of tank units, armored units, self-propelled artillery, and many ground troops. These are all massing near the Russian town of Yelnya, which is close to the border of Belarus. And then a separate analysis by Jane's Intelligence found that equipment from Russia's 4th Tank Division has recently been moved to areas around Bryansk and Kursk, which are close to Ukraine's northern border. So, Russia is now 7 years into its conflict with Ukraine. There have already been 13,000 people killed as a result of that conflict. Russia has already annexed a massive chunk of Ukraine as a part of the conflict, and it's locked much of the east of the country in kind of a simmering war there. And now, with Putin sending these troops to locations near Ukraine, it may be that the conflict there could just dramatically heat up again soon. And there was a very interesting statement about all of this Russian activity by Natalie Luiso. She's the head of the European Union's Security and Defense Subcommittee. She said, quote, "There are different ways with which Russia is interfering with our neighbors, and we are extremely concerned. You will always have Europeans seeing the Russian threat as a very immediate threat for our continent," end quote. So that statement, I think, shows just the real significance of this. Europeans are extremely concerned. They see the Russian threat as something that immediately threatens them. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has discussed just how fearful of Russia's aggression the Europeans are several times over the years. One of those was in an article he wrote shortly after Russia had annexed Crimea from Ukraine. And in that article, he discusses some Bible prophecies saying the nations of Europe will soon unite into an incredibly lethal military superpower. And then he writes, quote, "These prophecies are directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." So, the Europeans are fearful of Russia weaponizing energy and massing troops, as the EU security and defense head said there. They see that as an immediate threat, and many Europeans see that the best way to prepare to stand up to that threat is to unify several European nations together. So this will, just as Mr. Fleury wrote there, this will all play a big role in the unification of Europe that we're expecting.
All right. Well, the Crimean crisis is reshaping Europe. That's the title of the article from Gerald Fleury talking about this. And it is quite extraordinary to see just how strong Russia is being in pressuring Europe. You know that Europe is going to have to respond to this in a powerful way. And for some evidence of just how seriously European nations are taking such threats from Russia, just look at what's happening in Poland. They are preparing themselves for war. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is just powerful proof of what Jeremiah was saying. So on October 26th, the Polish defense minister announced plans for Poland to double the number of professional soldiers that it has, which is huge, more than double, 110,000 up to 250,000. So they're looking at making some massive changes to their defense over the next few years. And this is, it's big news when you have some of these countries making, say, a 10% increase in defense. That's big. You know, it's normally like 2 or 3%. Doubling is pretty vast. So he said that the deputy head of government responsible for security issues, he said the goal for this plan was to radically strengthen the armed forces. He said, if we want to avoid the worst, that is war, we have to act according to the old rule. If you want peace, prepare for war. So, you see this, and they're not at all hiding that Russia is the cause of this, that they're nervous about what is happening with Russia. And just as Jeremiah said, the doubling of armed forces is definitely the most eye-catching indication that they're getting very worried. But at the same time, you do see them moving closer to Europe, moving closer to Germany. You have a really interesting dynamic in Poland where, given Poland's history, they are naturally suspicious of both Russia and Germany being invaded and wiped out by the two of them on several occasions. But you see them moving closer and closer to Germany because of this growing threat that they see in Russia. So they recently had a meeting with the German defense minister, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, the Polish defense minister. And he said that the main topic of their discussion was challenges associated with aggressive Russian policies. And a couple of years ago, they joined the European Main Battle Tank Project, which is led by Germany and France. They're doing more and more to cooperate militarily with Germany. It was a previous administration, which was less Eurosceptic than the current one, that famously said, we no longer fear when Germany is strong. We fear when Germany is too weak, because they really are looking to Germany to defend them.
Hmm. You know, as you've been talking, I actually just went back and I was reminded of a trumpet cover that we did some years ago. This is actually the May-June 2014 issue that had that Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe article from Gerald Fleury. And on the cover is a picture of a bear that is very menacing on the horizon, and all of these people are running away from it, and there is the German eagle in the foreground that's ready to kind of take them under her wings. It's a pretty dramatic image, but it's exactly what you're describing. This is really a trend that we've seen for quite some time. Here you have Poland that is fearful of Russia, and it's driving them basically into the arms of Germany, effectively.
Right. And like you said, this is something that we've been warning about for several years. I mean, Jeremiah already kind of referenced the same prophetic points that I had. We've got right from that same article, that same picture, that article that Jeremiah mentioned is from that trumpet issue, The Crimea Crisis is Reshaping Europe. That is that cover, that cover article. And Mr. Fleury forecast exactly that. And he said that the fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea, and I think by extension, everything Russia is doing militarily, their current even military buildup next to Ukraine, is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy. A bit of overlap there with Jeremiah, but really that's exactly, we're seeing that. We're seeing exactly that. I mean, it's just like the Germany story that I have. We've been talking about these things for many, many years, and we are just seeing them play out now so frequently. It's Bible prophecy being fulfilled and moving forwards just at a tremendous pace.
Well, we do appreciate that very much, Richard. We will link to an article that we have up on the website right now from Josue Michels, Poland aims to double its armed forces. And I'll also put a link to that that trumpet issue, the May 2014 issue with that cover on it, and the link to Mr. Fleury's article, The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe. Many people in Lebanon say the Iranian-sponsored group Hezbollah has too much control in their country. Well, they're starting to receive some pretty strong support, in their view, from the government of Saudi Arabia. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
While Lebanon is a small country, there's been a lot of interest by other countries to dominate the nation. And the two countries with the most power there outside nations, I'd say outside the United States, or traditionally outside the United States, have been Iran backing Hezbollah and the Shiites, and then the Saudis, which typically backed the Sunni-led powers as well as some of the Christians. And there has kind of been a infighting and an interior war inside Lebanon for domination by the different sides that are backed by these two regional powers. And the Saudis this week basically said that they are acknowledging that Hezbollah, led by Iran, has way too much power, and that they are pulling out as much as they can from Lebanon. On Friday, Saudi Arabia decided that they were going to recall their ambassador from Lebanon and also boot the Lebanese ambassador out of Saudi Arabia. Bahrain, the UAE, they followed suit and joined Saudi Arabia in this. This came after there was comments released from the information minister in Lebanon, which basically accused Saudi Arabia for aggression in its war against the Houthis inside Yemen. The Houthis, of course, are another Iranian-backed group, ally of Hezbollah. And Saudis did not like this, and they said, we're out, we're done. And some commentators are looking at these remarks as basically an excuse for Saudi Arabia to go about what they wanted to do anyway, is that they were going to decide, they have decided that Lebanon, while they hope it makes a turn, they recognize that if they are going to still support the Lebanese state, the Lebanese institutions, they're basically supporting a Hezbollah-run government or an Iranian province on the Mediterranean. And so these are pretty decisive moves. They've also decided to ban all agricultural products coming in from Lebanon to Saudi Arabia, which accounts for over half of Lebanon's agricultural exports. So this is quite huge as well. They haven't decided as yet to kind of bar some of the business relationships between Lebanese citizens and Saudi Arabia, which would go into about $150 billion worth of trade. That would be the absolute decisive blow to the relationship. However, what we're really seeing here is, again, this acknowledgement that Hezbollah has taken over the state, the Saudis know they're going to support it, and they hope that the pressure that's going to exist inside Lebanon as the result of this decision makes the Lebanese people themselves decide to rise up and then throw off Iranian domination. That is what the other commentators are saying, plenty that I trust are saying by this. There's not Saudi Arabia giving up. It's saying that they can no longer, from outside in, implement change against the Iranians. Iran's hold in Lebanon, it has to be done by the Lebanese people.
Well, that is really fascinating. I guess some of what you were describing there, and just how dependent Lebanon is on Saudi Arabia for exports and such, I was not aware of that to that degree. And in some ways, you kind of wonder why Saudi Arabia didn't do this sooner. But if the explanation is, as these analysts say, that Saudi Arabia has basically determined that its position to effect change in Lebanon has kind of come to an end. It's very interesting to see this happening in light of what we've been talking about among the Lebanese people, and just how much they are, they're kind of done with Hezbollah. And there's a lot of resistance to Hezbollah's power within the nation. To receive this kind of support from Saudi Arabia, it does seem like not only would this be a prod to them to take their resistance to the next level, but that it would actually empower them as well. That you could see, especially when we're looking at what we expect to happen, prophetically speaking, within Lebanon, this being a pretty decisive moment for that country.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everything is coming to a head. We talked about that gun battle in the streets, I guess it was in early October, right, between Shiite forces and the Shiite forces dominated by Hezbollah to try and overturn the adjudication of the Beirut blast by a certain judge that looked to be really cracking down on the Shiites for being accomplices in the act, or at least being partly to blame for what happened back last year on August 4th. And then you've had this, which the Saudis are kind of pulling the plug. Even the Prince Faisal, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, he said, "I think we have come to the conclusion that dealing with Lebanon, its current government, is not productive and it's not helpful with Hezbollah's continuing dominance of the political scene." Mm. And so you have, from the inside, people being fed up with Hezbollah. And then you have the main financial backer of the Lebanese state, outside of what Iran gives to Hezbollah, pulling the plug as well. Hmm. And so the people are just, they could see it in two ways. They could see it, they're being deserted by Saudi Arabia, but they could see it as Saudi Arabia is just waiting for them to rise up against the institutions that have been hijacked by Hezbollah in that nation. It's also interesting to see what the United States is doing here, because you have the United States that's really trying to fund money as much as it can to the LAF, the official Lebanese army. This is after Saudi Arabia decided back in 2016 to pull its money from the LAF, saying that we're not going to be funding an army for the state of Lebanon if that army is going to be fighting alongside Hezbollah. And the United States is actually propping up the Lebanese army right now, much to Saudi Arabia's chagrin. And so this decision comes after that move by the Biden administration as well, which took place in early October. And so you do see a couple of things happening behind the scenes. The U.S. government propping up Lebanon, is Lebanon's institutions that are run by Hezbollah, and the Saudis pulling the plug, hoping that the Lebanese people rise up themselves to throw off Iranian dominance. Of course, biblical prophecy says this is going to happen eventually, that Iran is going to lose sway inside that nation. And that's why we cover Lebanon so closely. A good article that gets into the biblical prophecy about this is Mr. Gerald Flory's article from last year relating to the Beirut blast. And this is entitled, "Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon."
Okay, thank you very much for that, Brent. Excellent analysis. We're going to end now in the United States, where the Durham investigation actually made an important indictment this week. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we actually have a little bit of good news to end the program on this week. Igor Danchenko has been arrested. And if you didn't know, you were hoping for that. Igor Danchenko, he was the primary source for Christopher Steele in the now famous Steele dossier that kicked off the Trump-Russia collusion hoax. I guess in a nutshell, the Hillary Clinton campaign had hired a company called Fusion GPS to dig up dirt on Donald Trump. Fusion GPS, in turn, hired Christopher Steele, a former British intelligence agency, to look into Trump-Russia collusion. And then Christopher Steele sought out Igor Danchenko, who was a Russian analyst living here in the United States, who basically collected some barroom gossip from some of his buddies back in Russia, and then presented it as classified intelligence. Now, once Donald Trump was elected, he'd hired Bill Barr to look into the scam, and was kind of disappointed at how long it took him. But on his way out the door, Bill Barr appointed Stanley Durham a special counsel, so Biden couldn't fire him, to continue that investigation. And then finally, about 2 years into it, he's come out that Danchenko not only lied to the FBI about knowing that Steele was working for Clinton, he was trying to present himself like a nonpartisan analyst when he knew all along that who Steele was working for, but also told several other lies. I think he was convicted on 5 counts of lies about, like they said, the status of his sources back in Russia. I guess none of the people he got this barroom gossip from were nearly as important as he tried to paint them out to be. And so it is kind of nice heading into the weekend to see that this Russian analyst who was colluding with the Clinton campaign to frame Donald Trump, it might finally get some justice coming to him.
Well, it is a little bit of good news. Of course, it seems like the damage of what the Democrats actually did there has long been done. Dwight Falk, one of our producers here, sent me a quote earlier this week that says, if a lie be believed for only an hour, it has done its work. Falsehood flies and truth comes limping after. It kind of seems like that's what we see happening here. But we do, it is important to just understand the whole context of what has happened here. And all of this indictment and so much of what has been uncovered here in recent years shows just how dangerous what happened really is. Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, talked about this in several articles. One that actually puts what Danchenko has done in context is his article, Treason in America and Britain. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. We thank you very much for bringing that to us. Andrew, I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Sidney J. Harris. One way to distinguish truth from all its counterfeits is by its modesty. Truth demands only to be heard among others, while its counterfeits demand that others be silenced. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.